The Northern Factors, podcast by Lapland University of Applied Sciences.
My name is Tommi Haapakangas, and this podcast we are going to speak about adventure psychology with our two amazing guests. Paula Reed, she's just published a book about the adventure psychology. Welcome. And there's Ola-Matti Peltonen, who is a grand old man of any kind of adventure based.
I'm quite old too.
Adventure based activities here in Lapland. And our main goal for today is talk about have a non-formal discussion about the psychological side of the adventure. And that's, in my point of view, that's kind of a thing everybody who is working somehow or is included to adventure-based tourism or adventure-based education or adventures itself, it is kind of a thing that we speak, but we don't know quite much about it. And Ola-Matti is working with the risk management things and fear. Your tools are based on the excitement and fear, and Paula has a little different perspective to adventure as a endure adventurists.
Maybe endurance or being in nature or transcendence, other qualities, but I'm also interested to hear about fear, courage, risk, all those, they come up.
Yeah, so don't mind start a debate about the things, and let's just keep it non-formal discussion. Sure. I don't have any kind of schedule, or I don't have any kind of rules in here.
I have a list here.
You have a list here. It's unfortunate.
Don't test me too much.
It's unfortunate that we haven't had a chance to read the book yet, because it's just published and we have no copy of it. But we have abstracts. Can you tell me about a bit about the book and the process itself? How did it?
So I do lots of adventuring, and I have felt the physical and mental impact of my mindset on my performance, on my energy. I've skied to the South Pole. That took 46 days, and I had a severe leg injury from day 7. And I just felt the impact of my mind and state on my performance, energy, motivation, drive, mojo, all sorts. And I realized how much the mind can conquer or be more strong than the muscle quite often. So then I did a master's degree in applied positive psychology, which then brings in things like hope and optimism and goal setting and maybe visualization, but I prefer to think about anticipatory thinking. And I've mashed the two together, so I have merged my embodied experiences on adventures with the science and evidence of positive psychology, and putting them two together to look at how to survive, cope and thrive when there are challenging conditions, which includes mindset, fear, courage, success, failure, transformation, transcendence, our relationship with nature. There's such a lovely group of subjects under that umbrella, and I think everyone can benefit from knowing about these things, not just people on adventures.
Yeah, and I assume that you are a speaker as well for the business about these things.
Yes, I've got one small foot in the world of academia, not much, but the science and the evidence and the research is very important, so we understand the data. But also, having done a lot of adventures, I know how it feels and how I think and how it's experienced, phenomenologically myself. But then I also deliver a lot of these messages and tools. So I talk about the mindset, the skill set, and the tool set for every person to somehow get through the adventure of life, to navigate the journey with all of its obstacles and challenges and barriers. COVID being a great example, which was very mentally, a lot of mental struggle going through, and still now, of course. And how do we cope? How do we basically survive through to potentially thriving? Even when it's dangerous or difficult, we can thrive.
Yeah.
So in Finland, there is a lot of discussion about the resilience.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a part of this
Sisu.
The big picture, because of the COVID and this Ukrainian case and so on. But the resilience is actually one part of my work with the fear as well. And I'm actually doing a thesis. Did I say it right?
Thesis. But it's good.
Yeah. About the fear and the resilience in when you train with the students, for example, things in water. So there is the fear of water.
Mm.
It's a part of the fear is or actually the water, the fear of water is one part, and the fear of high places, heights is one part in adventure sports as well.
Mm.
And every year with the students, I see some of them crying, for example, because of the fear of water or fear of high places. And I try to find some kind of, for example, drills or exercise or safety things that I can, for example, tell to the students that do this or that, and you can face the fear easier. It can be probably different kind of
breathing
techniques, for example. It can be smiling, for example, when you go to the water and when you smile at the same time. So it means to your body that there is no reason for fear. And this kind of techniques I want to find.
Mm-hmm.
And I also do a lot of different kind of drills in a pool when we start to practice paddling, for example. So we do different kind of water and swimming exercises,
like exposure but in a safer environment.
Yeah, that's
first.
Right.
Yeah.
And drown proofing. Do you know the word drown proofing? Have you heard that kind of word? Or actually,
yes, but
which means it came from USA, from some technical school or technical university, some about in 1960s, and there was a one teacher who used drown proofing techniques to the students.
Mm-hmm.
And what is drown proofing? It's actually the thing that they put a rope to the legs, for example, and they keep their hands in the back of their body like that, and then they start to go to the water. And the drown proofing means that, of course, if there are a rope in your legs and you keep your hands like this, so there's no chance to survive. But it's the question of course, the technique, but the mental things as well. And we don't have such a translation for drown proofing in Finland. So there is drown proofing. They have done a lot, but in Finland, the Finnish military don't have a word for that. So this is interesting part for
it. It is.
Yeah.
It's, for me, it's a bit of the endurance point as well, where we have mental limits or superficial or pretend limits. They're not actually our limits. So there's some interesting research about how long we can hold our breath underwater, and it's way beyond what we perceive to be our limit. So apparently after maybe 2 to 3 minutes, we think that is it. I'm going to die and stop. But actually, if we can push through that, then we can hold our breath, or I can't, but lots of people have done amazing lengths of time because of that. A bit like, you know, the petrol in your car, when the gauge is saying you're nearly out of petrol, you need to stop now, but actually we've got more in us. So I wonder whether that ground proving is partly, there might be a limit, but beyond that limit, if we break through, there are deeper capabilities and oxygen resources within us. But that's not really discussed much in the UK either, that I know of.
So this man, I just checked the name because I forget it, but anyway, he got about 20,000 students who did this kind of ground proofing course, and it was mandatory course. They had to do it if they want to go through that university, technical university, and it was strange, but it was a part of it. And I have to check.
Quite a rite of passage.
Yeah.
I mean, maybe, but a bit like other youngsters do in other countries, and they go through these extreme tests and challenges. Interesting.
But you both think that the adventure, it doesn't mind that, it doesn't matter if it's like short pace adventure or like endure adventure, the body and mind connection is crucial to cope with.
Yeah, so I'm a big believer in, you know, the systems theories are perhaps experiencing a resurgence of, you know, the mind and body are so connected, and that's within the context of the environment and within the context of social people, maybe. So the extension of everything, and I think psychology concentrates too much on the brain, although psyche, of course, is more, I like the word spirit, the spirit of us, whatever that is, whatever we believe. But I mean, the mind and body are so close. But now we're talking about different types of brains and the extended brain, but also within a context, and then the dynamic relationship between the activity, the environment, the person, and the state, and it's all very subjective and unique, and it's just quite complex, but it is a system, isn't it? And
it is.
One massively affects the other. But in the book, on the chapter of endurance, they quite often think that oxygen is the physical measurement of whether we can continue or endure or not. So oxygen being the limiting factor, or VO2 max or whatever. But what they're proving now is that we can actually endure without oxygen, as it were, underwater being the proof, where you have to keep your face, you know, within the water for way longer than was thought, which seems to be a psychological switch rather than a physical running out of air, which fascinates me. You know, this whole stuff, our abilities and resources, I think, are way more than we realize, and we're just discovering that now.
You both have been kind of operating with a huge amount of people who face fear, face excitement, or face challenges that are kind of beyond unbelievable. Is there any archetypes of personalities that kind of cope with this kind of elements of stress more like better than the others? Who are those who start to cry, for example, when they are hanging on the ropes? Or is there a kind of personalities?
I don't know about the personality, but it can be, for example, with water, it can be a memory from childhood.
A trauma.
Yeah, a trauma. And more, I see many cases that they remember a thing that they have went submerged, and they remember a hand of father or mother who is taking him or her away from the water, and it has been a close call. And
I think there's a book called The Body Keeps the Score,
yeah.
which I haven't yet read, but it's, you know, something in our body has the memory of something, even if we can't cognitively bring it to form. Right.
But the fear of high places, the heights, so probably that's the thing that, let's say, most of the people don't know, because you know the water, you have been in the water, but if you don't like the high places, so you are probably not sure that what happens when you go to the place which is high and you have to go somewhere using a rope down or up. So then you know it, that I didn't know that I had that kind of fear of heights. Sometimes it's like that, but and you can avoid high places if you have that kind of fear that so then you don't go to the high places. But every now and then there are students who come studying to my courses, and I ask them, do you have a fear of water, or for example fear of high places, and they said that no, I don't have. But probably they don't know themselves that they don't, that they have that kind
maybe,
of fear.
Yeah.
Or sometimes they know it, but probably it can be also like that they want to face the fear, maybe in safe place in the school, maybe, and that's why it's interesting that because it's the safe place. When we do it in the pool, when we do it in the high place, we have the ropes, we have the safety systems for that. So it's easy, and it's the safe way to face the fear. And probably you can go over that fear. And I would say it's a one possible way to manage the fear.
Well, it reminds me of this fact that you can have maybe a plank or a piece of wood or a beam to walk along, which is maybe 30 centimetres wide, and if it's near to the ground, you're happy to walk across it. But if it's over a chasm or, you know, there's a big drop underneath, you can't do it. It's the same. It's the same physical activity, the same objective task. But it's your mind that's making the difference, isn't it? With the safety or not safe. But also going back to your question about personality type, I think one of the more common ones that are referenced is, funny enough, the Big Five, which is sometimes described as ocean or canoe, which are great words to use for adventure. So that each letter represents a type, but openness to experience is the main one quoted in relation to adventure. Whether people are on a continuum, more open to experience, or really not at all open to experience. That's one of the main ones that are relevant, I guess, to this discussion, but not necessarily to do with, you know, our appetite for risk or challenge. I'm not scared of heights or water. I presume you're not, unless you've conquered it amazingly and now do the job that you do. But I find it fascinating to separate risk from fear. So one of the things I'd like to discuss with you is my little pet theory, which is, for instance, before I went to Antarctica, I had 31 different things that were concerns or worries. I realised that that list contained half were risks and half were fear. With risks, apply risk management or safety management or whatever you do, instruct, learn, get the right kit, insurance, whatever. So 15 of my worries before Antarctica were managed by risk management strategies. However, half were still subjective internal fears. And that's where you need some of the other techniques, like the breathing you mentioned, or laughter to change your state. So my little theory is separate the risks from the fears, and you deal with them differently. They have different sort of strategies or management to deal with them. And one's subjective and internal and human and, you know, unique to each of us. So maybe the solutions are potentially quite unique too. But yeah, it's interesting, isn't it, to look at them as two different categories and therefore two different strategies to manage. I want to do a TED talk about that, by the way. So yeah.
How do you cope with fears then?
How do I cope with fear?
You've been in a sailing competitively in around the world 10 months. You've been skiing in the South Pole. You've been in a river which I don't remember. You told
the
me
the Mekong.
Mekong River, paddling with the kayak that it's made by the natives.
Yeah,
and just a huge adventures, not knowing where to go.
Mm.
And of course there are fears and risks involved, and risk management can handle the risk, but how do you cope the fears?
Yeah, so I think I probably have like 40 techniques altogether. Okay. You know, there's so many and they're all in my kit bag, and there's probably more that I will learn in the future. And I learned a lot of them before I did my degree in psychology, so they were just instinctive maybe. But you mentioned two. One was breathing. Laughter, so changing the state. They're really good ones, you know. Mm. Trouble with breathing, though, is it can make you feel more tense. So people say, take a breath or breathe. And you're like, but if you're breathing it in, like I've just done, and it almost, you know, stopped me from, it feels more tense. So I think breathing out first is a technique. Breathe out first. Let your breath out, because otherwise you're holding it in.
Mm.
Or box breathing is known. Peripheral vision has come out recently into research. So foveal vision is our sharp focus. Narrow vision, which is linked to our sympathetic nervous system, which is our fight, flight, freeze. But peripheral vision, if we can engage that, it calms us down again. So there's lots of these fascinating techniques. If you have the wherewithal to try and use your peripheral vision when you're scared, but that obviously takes some self-control or regulation. I use laughter a lot. I use music or changing the state with dancing, physical, playing, laughing, music just changes the state. Curiosity is a great one. If you can engage curiosity, so if you're clinging to a mountain and you're scared, then trying to be curious about how you're feeling or what your fingers are doing or the moss in front of your eyes, and just look at the moss and the way it's designed, and that can calm you down. And I use that quite a lot. So I personally use laughter because I like it. Music, I love music. If it's pumped up and it's some of my favourite tracks, it will really make me feel stronger and better. Curiosity I use a lot. I'm also quite fact and data. I quite like my data. So the mathematics of something, or motivation to do so many miles or minutes, or you know, to contract with myself to just do one more hour or one more mile.
Yeah,
that will get me through sometimes the dark time. Hope and optimism. Goals. I'm really a big one for goals. That just keeps me going through all sorts. And reminding myself of why I'm doing something. So if it's for charity or a goal or people that are interested, or you know, something, you know, re-engage with the why. So re-motivate myself. I use loads. There's so many, and I've just built them up over the years. Sailing one was, I think, the most dangerous because it's dynamically dangerous with the weather and the ocean and Cape Horn. So 22 meter waves when you're on a little boat going the wrong way. So we went westwards against the conditions, really dangerous. And for that, really, it was incremental, like the exposure theory, I think. You know, it was incremental from Buenos Aires to Wellington. It just got more and more dangerous and more rough, and the waves got bigger and bigger. But you acclimatise, and by the end, by Cape Horn, it's a joyride. You know, you're enjoying it. Because yesterday it was also hard, and today you know, bring it on. So many different techniques. I think you know everyone needs to build their own tool bag.
Yeah, then that was very enlightening, that those are operative level of techniques everybody can use. Just need to find the right ones,
yeah,
which are suitable for you. And I think we talked about this earlier, the meaning of routines in endure adventures, that for myself, I like to think that when the poop hit the fan situation, there are always my routines.
Yes.
I can rely on when the things are getting tough and the motivation is going down. There is some basic routines, environment that I can master, and when I get back to those routines, they kind of give me a self-esteem and boost that this might work actually, and then things start to build up in the better way.
And if you're mentally fatigued, you have less resources, you have less solutions to cope. Exactly. So if you're in difficulty and you're mentally fatigued as well, then your solutions or problem solving skills or creative thinking or ability to calm down is reduced greatly. So I think having the routines and habits help you function without too much thinking.
Yeah.
So it releases some mental capacity to then cope with crisis, for instance. It also makes you feel strong and capable and confident and like you are making progress.
Exactly.
So when I describe, again, skiing to South Pole, if I wasn't cleaning my teeth, I knew I was in trouble. If I couldn't even clean my teeth twice a day, then clearly I was not coping. And somehow I needed to change my perception or my activity so I was coping again. So yeah, they're important. The habits, routines, discipline, structure, regularity of some events, something to hold on to. Yeah, good one.
How about the sisu?
Yeah, chapter in the book.
Chapter in the book. There is actually
a finished chapter.
Finished chapter in the book, and that's quite an interesting thing. Well, there are many. Another one we already actually talked about was this post-traumatic growth, and sisu. I think they are kind of connected somehow. How do you see sisu?
I love sisu. So you talked about resilience before. There's resilience, mental toughness, hardiness, grit, perseverance. There are a lot of psychological concepts which us psychologists like to make them different and detailed, but actually they're roughly mental toughness, right? But sisu, I came across, it is a Finnish concept, a Finnish word. You've got tough people up here. So there are tough words and mindsets, I think, that come from difficult places where people live. So Scandinavia, Iceland, Alaska, there's some tough mindsets that have, I think, evolved over many years. Sisu, if I'm pronouncing it properly, is in effect what in England we call second wind. So you think you've reached the limit of your skill, strength, energy, capability, life, but somehow something comes up and gives you a second depth of energy or skill or something, and it comes to your rescue. So that's specifically how sisu is described. You think you're at the limit.
Yeah.
And in England, there's a lovely phrase which is second wind,
Have you heard it?
So second energy, second puff, second breath.
Second
breath, I don't know.
Second wave.
And then Amelia Elizabeth Larte, who wrote the chapter, she specializes in sisu. She's now moved it on to describe gentle power. So too much power can potentially kind of kill you, because if you carry on too much, you can die, right? Mm-hmm. So you need to know when to quit or when to stop, ideally, if you can. So she now specializes in gentle power, where you do need to have the power to continue, but you need to also be kind or compassionate to yourself as to whether you are going to survive or not. So she's moved it slightly onto slightly different meaning. Sisu and resilience and that sort of mental toughness to persevere. Again, in England, we use the word grit a lot because it's a very British word, I guess, but we also need to know when to stop.
Yeah.
And when to call it a day. And so I talk about legitimate, this is a bit English, sorry, legit quitting, legit quit or shit quit. Sorry if I'm not meant to swear, but you know, too late. There's good quitting and there's bad quitting, right?
Yeah. What is bad quitting for
when you probably shouldn't? There's going to be times on an adventure or a climb or an exhibition where it gets really difficult, of course. And that's when you want to quit. You want to stop, go home, have a cup of tea, get suddenly warm, comfortable, dry, safe, something. There's always going to be that voice calling you to stop when it gets difficult. And I would say in most cases you should carry on, because we are very capable, and the pride and achievement and sense of success and I did that, you know, I can do that, hashtag, you know, this girl can type of stuff is, mm-hmm. is massive, and it will feed you in future activity. But now and again, death will occur. So,
yeah,
you know,
eventually.
It requires a lot of self-regulation to make the right decision at the right time. But most of the time, I think we benefit from continuing, from carrying on, even if it's just for one more mile, one more hour.
Yeah, life is a bitch and then we die.
Yeah.
That's
and when the going gets tough, the tough get going.
Yeah, exactly.
What's your opinion? I'd love to hear, you know, what your experiences of risk or risk management or our relationship with risk, because in the book we describe it as a benevolent guide and a focusing force, so it's good for us to feel fear. But what do you think?
Should we be fearless or good?
Of course we need to feel fear, because otherwise if we don't feel fear, so we are dangerous for ourselves. It's it's obvious. But this is actually the big scene is this. Like I told you, in adventure education and in program services and customer services. So if we, for example, 150,000 tourists comes here every Christmas time in Rovaniemi and in Lapland area, and it's an adventure for them. And if we tell them, for example, if when they take a part for a ski-doo safari, for example, or reindeer safari, or they go to swim to the ice swimming place or wherever. So if we tell them all the risks, what can happen there, so we should do that because of the law. We have that kind of customer law in Finland that we need to tell to the tourists, for example, that there are these different kind of risks, and you need to know that.
Mm-hmm.
And even you need to know that if the guide is not able to continue, for example, so you need to do something yourself. So here is survival things, for example, in this bag, and you have to take it and you have to call in this number. Okay, but what happens then when we tell all these risks, for example, to the tourists? So we have seen already that in Finland, and it was a inspection of a authority in one company, and there was a couple of tourists from I don't know which country, but anyway, the inspector want to see that what kind of a
briefing
and safety things they tell them. So after that, when he tell them that if something happens to me as a guide, so here, here is the rescue bag and take that and call that number. So they leave the house and left the building, because they said that if this is so dangerous, we can do that.
Yes.
We thought that this is safe.
Yeah.
So if we tell all these risks, what can happen, so what happens to the person? The person start to be stiff.
Yes.
And like in sport, you need to be relaxed that you can manage and you can make the top performance. But if you are stiff, so what you can do? Nothing. And this is the thing which is very critical, I would say, in program services and in customer services. And actually, is it like that you have to know all the risks because if you
it
can't
makes
handle,
it more risky maybe.
Yeah, after that, you are a person who can't act when something really happens. And
good point.
That's the point, which is.
That's fascinating.
Yeah, it's difficult, for example, if I have a company and I know that we have plenty of risks, so should I tell all the risks or keep?
But you're right. If somebody's
something.
Too stiff or too scared,
right.
or even their mind closes, so they're
that's
narrow-minded,
right. yeah.
their brain doesn't function as well, let alone their
yeah.
body. They will perform less well, so they'll be more likely
that's
to have
right.
an accident, more likely
yeah.
to break a leg, more likely to not enjoy the experience.
Yeah.
So
but
that's an interesting.
The law says one, but the common sense says another thing.
And also the guide or the relationship with the experience ideally is a bit fun, or they're enjoying the scenery. I've seen so many maybe tourists whose face is so set with worry or fear or uncertainty, they're not enjoying the scenery. They're not stopping to look at the trees or the snow or the reindeer.
Yeah. So this is one example what happened in this season, and it was actually a program service where you float and survival suit on, lying in on your back in the water and watching perhaps aurora borealis or maybe black sky. But but anyway, when you are there, so if we, I'm not sure did they tell it like this, that if you go to the water, so there's the cold shock tomorrow.
I will experience that.
And okay, it's a risk.
Yes.
But after 1 minute, after 1 minute, you will be okay.
Yeah, and that's good for us.
Yeah, but yeah, that's right. But what happened? So they went floating to the ice hole, and somebody threw water, cold water, to the ice, and. One customer started panicking, and he flipped, and the face was on the water.
Yes,
and he took the water to the lungs, and the heart stopped, and they have to start the CPR.
Yes,
and okay, the result was good. He came back, but we have had this kind of close call, for example, this season over here.
I can imagine that.
And and this is the problem that. Is it like that you need to know the things about the cold shock? Okay, you should know something about that when you go to the water, but when you have this rescue suit on, so there wouldn't be that kind of cold shock. But if you have a cold water in your face, so then the cold shock can start. So
it's a fine line.
Yeah, so that was one example of it, and
because I'm all for people taking risks, because it's good for us, right? It helps us to build the muscle, the muscles of responsibility, responsibility. Any survival training is helping you to go through already experiences, so you're quicker at responding next time. You have more skills, more knowledge, more wisdom. More ability to respond appropriately. So we need to go through some difficult times and learn to cope. And if we're too cotton wool balled, which is what we say, surrounded in cotton wool, then how are we going to learn and grow and develop our ability to cope? But life these days requires less, perhaps less coping skills, because we're, you know, you talk about tourists, if people are coming from a city and they work in a city, then their environment is an apartment block and their office is air conditioned, and they just have to go from one to the other, and they have a very comfortable lifestyle, which might suit them. They might be a bit sedentary perhaps, or languish. They're not learning skills to cope. But maybe they don't need to. Maybe their whole life will be quite easy and comfortable. But I do believe in putting people through challenging experiences, and it's, safety tourism is a thing. And I know a story of some tourists who thought a white water rafting experience was going along, you know, a cable under the water. They thought they were attached to a cable in a white water experience. So yeah, it's, yeah. There's so, a line somewhere.
So this tourism is one thing. The other one is the schools and young kids.
Mm-hmm.
And the way where we are going at the moment, so the result won't be good, because I know it already happens in UK, and it start to be like here that the teachers won't go outside with the children because mm-hmm. there are some kind of risks, or actually the question is the parents.
Mm-hmm.
They say that my daughter or my son, it's not good to go outside because they can take their phone there and or lose their phone there or slip or whatever can happen there. It's easier to stay inside. Mm-hmm. And this is the big thing as well, that if you don't face the risks, for example, as a child, you don't go outside. Mm. You don't know what is cold weather.
Mm.
Okay, it's not good idea to go outside and to thin ice, for example, to the lake. Mm. But I would say that my age persons know, because we did it. We climbed to the trees. We know it, that mm. this tree is not good enough for climbing. We mm. we knew it somewhere.
You learn the hard way sometimes.
Yeah, we learn that risk management
mm.
by doing.
Yes.
And the thin ice as well, because we hear that if there's a crack, we knew that should we continue yes. or go back. But nowadays, the parents are like that it, don't go there because it's dangerous.
Yes.
And it's the same with the sports as well.
Mm-hmm.
I have, maybe this is some kind of legend, you can say, is it true? But in UK, they say that, for example, push-ups, it's forbidden to make push-ups in the schools because it can make harm to your wrists when you are a child.
Mm.
I have heard this, maybe. And running, if you do running with the school children, you should have a soft
surface.
Soft mm. surface that it's okay, because mm. otherwise you can your knees and your ankles are
sprained.
That's right.
Yeah.
So if we are going that way, that we don't face
mm.
risks, different kind of weather, the cold weather and the rain and whatever. So in the end of that road, there is a catastrophe, because if
mm.
something really happens, I mean,
mm.
the electricity goes like this.
Mm.
Off, and next 3 weeks we are without electricity here,
yeah.
for example, here in Finland, and it's -20
mm.
and we haven't tried different skills, for example,
mm.
because it's dangerous to try to have a knife and make a fire, for example.
Mm.
So in the end of that road, there's a catastrophe, because we don't know
yes
how we
yes.
should do there.
I agree.
Yeah.
100%.
Mm.
Although what I was saying was before is maybe some people will have a sedentary lifestyle, you know, if they are living in a city,
mm.
working in a city, and certain countries more
mm.
than other countries. Maybe it doesn't matter if they learn survival skills, but hope that nothing
mm.
happens to them. Although COVID, I think, was a good example.
Mm.
None of us could manage or expected it. So something could come in and test
mm.
our abilities,
mm.
but also I think for our physical and mental health. So not just the lifestyle lessons
mm.
that are useful to know if there's a power cut, but definitely for our physical health, movement and muscle and exercise
mm.
and fresh air
mm.
and nature, but also for our mental health.
Mm.
Otherwise we languish, we fail to grow, we just get static
mm.
and the world moves on, and if we languish, we're not growing or adapting.
Mm.
But also mentally and physically, we're just not using our muscles,
mm.
and we will deteriorate or go soft potentially over many years.
Mm.
So I think in England, yes, there is this trouble about safetyism, or the health and safety culture, which I personally have a big problem
mm.
with, wearing goggles to play Conkers with the kind of the big nuts with strings that we hit each other with. I mean, this is all fun childhood games. And maybe even designed to help us to
mm.
learn to cope. But it's a similar concept to not be able to lose at sports as well in English schools now. Mm. So you have a game of football and the teacher is told, don't keep the score because you can't have a losing team. Yeah. I mean, it's the same approach. It's as you say, it's catastrophic. Mm. We're not learning to lose. Mm. We're not learning to deal with failure or being the losing team, like we're not losing using the physical survival skills either.
So I would say that we are in a critical point at the moment here in Finland and also probably in UK, wherever, because of this, that if we continue like this, so...
We devolve.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
Exactly. And that's why we need to have these conversations, Tommy. Yeah. That's why we do what we do, because we are passionate advocates of nature, sport, movement, adventure, expeditions, pushing ourselves, risk management, and all that growth. Mm. That's why we do what we do, and that's why this is an important conversation to get more people challenged and being challenged.
That's right.
And I think we all agree that adventure is part of inner self-development processes. It's all about, there is always a part of nature involved. But then in your book, there was this fifth perspective.
Yes.
That's really interesting.
Okay.
And when I see through the abstracts, I noticed that there is so many studies speaking about reconnect to nature through adventures, and that's really interesting stuff for me, because that's my area of study, to kind of try to figure out ways how to really make people to connect to nature, and I use adventure pedagogics for one part. Can you tell us about this five perspective of nature, adventure?
So everyone always says define adventure. It's a very difficult thing to define. And you could say it's everything and anything. It's up to the person how they experience the world. Or you can say specifically it's a set thing. But I agree it has to be outside. Because if it's an inside environment, it's pre-planned and pre-made, constructed, so it can't be adventure, and it hasn't got the weather, which adds another element. So the five frameworks we describe at the start of the book to try and define adventure really is, the first of all, as an activity. So there could be an adventurous activity which describes adventure, and that as well is difficult to define, because an extreme sport, I think, quite often is an adventurous activity, but lots of other traditional sports aren't. So, anyway, I won't go fully into that right now. So adventure by activity can be a definition. Adventure, how it is experienced through the person, is another framework. So somebody living in Mumbai who comes to Finland, or vice versa, they would experience different adventures because their life is a different place. So through the person, the way they uniquely and subjectively experience is an adventure. So me maybe making a cake, if I haven't made a cake before, you could say was an adventure. I disagree, but the third way is the context. So it has to be about the context in which you are for it to be an adventure, which is outdoors, nature, the weather, the environment, the terrain, terra incognita, the context in which you are playing or adventuring or journeying, wayfair. So activity, person, context. The fourth one, which is an easy one I think to agree with, is the dynamic interplay or relationship between those three. So it's an activity of some sort with a person's unique subjective experience of it within a context which we agree is outdoors, but that could be all sorts of different things. So that's the fourth one. The fifth one we posit in the book is it's a state, so a bit like flow or love. So it's the dynamic interplay of those four previous ones, but it is actually a state of being, and it's a combination of factors I haven't got the book on me at the moment, but there is quite a nice description if anyone does get it, where it creates a state. So flow as a state is described as high challenge, high skill. It does contain some of those elements, but also within a natural setting and so on. So that's our fifth framework that we were suggesting in the book.
Yeah, that's very, very interesting stuff. Do you have any thoughts about it?
I have to read the book first.
I can answer that.
Everyone buy the
book.
But
you're saying, in this fifth perspective, you're saying also that adventure has a profound benefits for both people and planet.
Yes.
How does
yes.
the planet?
Right, right.
Was this the frame you were?
So also, my biggest takeaway myself from this book, you know, you write about it, you think about it, you have fresh thoughts and concepts and aha moments and insights. But my final biggest output for me is that symbiotic relationship with nature. So the last chapter, there's chapters in here about transcendence and the environment and our relationship with nature. But the last chapter was called Giving Back to Nature. And at the moment, of course, there's a lot of discussion around saving the planet and mm-hmm. Being, you know, consciously eco-friendly and all that. So Giving Back to Nature was the title of the last chapter. And I thought, hold on a minute, that is still quite human-centric. It's still quite patronising. Mm-hmm. Nature gives us back a lot. And the gift that it gives, the fresh air, the green therapy, the beauty, awe of trees and stars and flowers and swimming. So actually, we just called it giving back because both people and planet have to have this two-way relationship, I think. So I think it's still quite patronizing or egocentric of us to say, let's save the planet, because I think actually we're trying to say, let's save ourselves mm-hmm. so we don't destroy the planet so that we can carry on surviving as a human race. But the planet gives so much to us, and it's a very strong ecosystem. And I think adventure psychology, a lot of it is being outdoors, experiencing nature. Ideally, of course, not destroying it. But I think the gift that we receive from being in nature is massive. So I think for me, adventure psychology is quite special at the moment because it's not an indoor sport. It's an outdoor, recreational, accessible thing for us all to do, but it's very much intertwined with the context and our experience with nature, not just in nature. And we are natural beings, of course, ourselves. So it's a bit like Avatar or mm-hmm. the concept of biophilia, where we feel very connected with nature, but it's definitely a two-way relationship.
Yeah, I agree. And I've used the phrase, like you need to how does it translate?
Say it in Finnish, maybe.
You need to you need to love nature first before you can protect it.
Mm-hmm.
And that's kind of a framework I like to think that how to create love for the nature, and it's not just the mindfulness, nature-based therapy things. It's about our relationship to nature and feeling the elements.
The oneness as well.
Yeah, and the oneness and feeling the elements and staying in the nature alone, not always with the group, having a time, not detailed plan what to do with the nature, but just like to kind of interact with the nature.
Mm.
Those are the elements that create experiences from the nature, and that way they start to produce love against the nature.
Mm.
And when you love the nature, then you can really protect the nature, and we can,
because it matters.
It
makes
matters.
It matter.
Yeah, there needs to be kind of a meaning for the nature, and I've noticed that these with the students, these adventure-based, experienced in a nature, in harsh conditions. Those are the elements they remember the rest of their life. They like to go back into place where it happens on their spare time. They like to reconnect, re-memorize the adventures they had with the friends. And it somehow moves something inside of them. And they start to respect the nature totally different way.
Yeah.
And they take it as a part of their everyday life. And when I see that happens, I get hopeful that, okay, we don't just consume the nature.
I've shifted.
We make things that helps nature to provide well-being for us in the future.
Yes, and the book talks about those three stages we go through. I think consumption was the first stage where we're using nature, obviously, to create fire or to cook. Then it was a combat, it was a battle with nature. So some of those extreme experiences maybe students have, it might be a more combative relationship, but ideally the next higher level, if you like, is the collaborative phase, where it's not a battle. We're not trying to conquer the waves or the mountains, but we're actually trying to have a collaborative relationship with it, where we are going with the flow of nature and we're enjoying the seasons or the changes or the waves coming in and going out or whatever that is. So I think a lot of people are still on the consumption or combat conquering relationship, and ideally we're shifting more towards the collaborative, symbiotic, two-way, unconditional positive regard for each other stage.
I did think of that myself, that I need to develop the skills to cope with the nature in the hardest conditions, but then suddenly I realized that that's not the way actually, and I started to use this not time-bounded, not activity-bounded approach to nature with the students, and I want to just push them there and giving them time to adapt what's happening and get kind of interested what's around them, and that makes a huge difference about for the mindset. But I'm not sure if it's possible without those two elements you mentioned, the battle and the
consumption.
Other. Yeah, the consumption. I've done those in my life, so is that a kind of a process, or can we go straight into?
I don't know. I mean, there's evolutionary psychology, which is why we now think and feel what we now think and feel, and it's because of evolution and what we've gone through in the past. I don't know if we have gone through those phases as a human race, or whether each individual needs to go through those phases, or whether we can be born straight into, you know, the sort of community which respects and has a two-way relationship. Yeah. I'm always hopeful. I'm an optimistic person, and I like to think that we are moving in the right direction, albeit a lot of things that still need to be fixed and sorted. And it's, you know, eco-anxiety is massive now, and I think the younger generations do have a bit of a challenge, but I'm hopeful and optimistic that we are going in the right direction.
You say that you have a like a soul picture in jungle, and have you ever visited with the natural tribes? And how do you see their relationship to nature? They kind of...
So yes, I've been to like the Amazon or West Papua, Borneo, Kalimantan, so real deep jungle tribes without much, I never know what word to use, civilization, you know, without much mechanical, you know, constructions and consumerism and all that. And I don't sound patronising, I just think they've got quite a good life going on. And I know they want the t-shirts or the cigarettes or the money or the tourism. So it can sound like a Western white patronizing point of view, but actually when I really look at them, I think they've got a better life, and that the stresses that we experience in Europe or America, ridiculously, if we get an email or too many emails or or, you know, things that we, our laptop just pinging a noise that can really get us down. You know, it's, I think we have a worse life, and their simplicity, which sounds patronizing, but their absolutely simple and two-way relationship they have with their environment and their communities and families and children and older people and nature is fantastic. But of course they want the other, or not all of them, but you know, I can understand if they want the tourism or the dollars. But I, my happy place is in the jungle with a tribe of people who I just communicate with through hand signals and eye contact.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I have a friend who lives now in Helsinki, but she used to live 2 years in Tanzania in some tribe.
Mm-hmm.
She was married with one of the men from the tribe, and she said that that was very ascetic.
Mm-hmm.
Aesthetic environment, but that was her happy time.
Mm.
When she'd get back in Finland, the stress and everything started to kind of push through.
Yeah.
Hey, okay. I'm sure that we can continue this with the pint or something, but,
okay.
But if there's a conclusion, you said why. Why, what is your opinion? Why should we have an adventure?
Yeah. As a should conclusion. I go first or let you thinking?
I have one idea about the adventures. Why do we have, or do we, is there in adventure education, for example, something that we can take to the sports and sport instruction? This is the one topic I thought here, and I would say that we have, in, for example, Finnish Ski Instructors Association updated the pedagogical things just this season, and they took this kind of idea of adventure education to the ski instructed things, that there should be physical safety, psychological safety, and social safety, three different kind of safety circles that we need to use in when we are teaching skiing, for example.
Mm-hmm.
And this is the idea what probably which comes to the sports more and more from the adventure education side, and I would say that this is the common thing, and this is the future of sport instructing, when we, because we just talk about the risks and persons and fears and everything, so the instructors need to know not only the sport but these mental things and psychological and social things and safety issues, so three circles at least, maybe there are more circles, but I would say that this is the future, and it already is in Ski Instructors Association, for example.
Interesting. I think elite sports have had a few commentators in the last few years, like the Olympics. I remember, you know, there's a few elite sport performers who are broken, or they've just been pushed too hard, and they can crash, or you know, they lose their identity or life after competing at an elite level, and that has been commented on a bit lately. So I think the psychological safety or the mental health or well-being of sports performers is becoming more important and more understood or aware. But also I think the human race generally, you know, we're suffering a lot of anxiety and depression and suicidal tendencies more and more. And so mental health and mental well-being is massive. I think adventure is a fantastic solution, because I was listening to a webinar last night and it talked about interventions, and you know, it's pharmaceutical, for instance, drugs, or translucent properties of that's coming back into fashion, if you like, or therapy, which is quite often in a locked room, you know. So I think let's get outside, get out into the natural world, which is a very well, I don't know what to call it, whether it's nature's chemist or nature's, I don't know, but the healthiness of moving, being outside, getting some fresh air, and having to struggle and learn to cope is just so good for us. And I just want to finish the phrase that came to mind when you were speaking about your three circles is, we need to go knowingly into the unknown. So it's okay to have the right kit, training, safety skills, drills, classroom talking about psychological safety and social support. So let's go knowingly, so with an amount of confidence and skill set, but then we still need to take that leap into the unknown to explore the future, tomorrow, innovation, invention, testing ourselves, finding out stuff. Otherwise we're not going to progress, but the foundations of going knowingly help us to therefore then go into the unknown, which to me is an adventure. And an adventure is defined as a future challenging undertaking, which basically life is. So we shall see where it takes us.
Yeah, exactly. That was a very good ending for our interview moment. We've been talking about 1 hour, and I think we will stop now and continue without the recording part. So,
but with the beer that you just promised.
Yeah, I promised you a beer, so... Okay, thank you all.